From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Hey, if you happen to live in the greater Seattle area, here's some great news for you. Beginning on January 3rd on KIRO-FM 97.3, you will start hearing Coast to Coast AM on that huge station. Information on that on the coasttocoastam.com website. Well, here we are in the Thanksgiving holiday season, travel season, the ongoing furor over the Transportation Security Administration's stepped-up security measures, showing no signs of abating as the agency gears up for the nation's busiest day of the travel over the holiday season. TSA officials say they're considering some kind of scale back, but they're just not so sure yet. Already, all over the internet, pictures of a little boy that apparently is being patted down shirtless, and everybody seems to be very upset. Something's got to be done. Meanwhile, Michael Chertoff, he's the former secretary for the Department of Homeland Security. Well, he now runs a security and risk management firm, and one of his clients, called Rapiscan, happens to be one of the biggest manufacturers of body scanning machines in the country. And while the media continues to interview him about the value of body scanning machines, they fail to point out that he apparently benefits financially from the implementation of some of these machines. U.S. authorities are on the hunt for a radioactive mouse, is a story at coasttocoastam.com. Living in the grounds of a historic nuclear weapons production plant, radioactive mouse droppings discovered in the grounds of the Hanford plant in Washington State. It comes 2 weeks after a radioactive rabbit was caught at the same site. Hanford workers have set about 60 mouse traps, but the two mice there have not been caught so far. The Washington State Department of Health says it does not believe there's any danger to the public. If I was one of those workers, I'd want to get tested myself. Drinking glasses depicting comic book and movie characters such as Superman, Wonder Woman, and the Tin Man from The Wizard of Oz apparently exceed federal limits for lead in children's products by up to 1,000 times. And these decorative enamel on the superhero glasses, made in China. Our food safety expert, Jeff Nelkin, with us. And Jeff, no surprise, made in China, no quality control.
Hi, George.
Hi, Jeff. So what do we do about it? Another product made in China, no quality control.
Well, you know, it's just getting to be a little bit annoying when you think about all these companies that are pushing these glasses. And there's all this controversy between the companies that make the glass and the companies that make the decorations, and they're arguing about the laboratory results. The bottom line is that this lead and cadmium causes damage to kidneys and bones in the children, and over a period of time of grabbing these glasses and putting their fingers into their mouths, they could end up with some damage. And, you know, these people need to get together and say, you know what, folks? We need to protect our children and not worry about selling glasses.
Absolutely. And Jeff, can you get that much toxicity from lead from glasses like that?
Well, generally adults not. But, you know, when we're talking about children that are holding it and then putting, you know, rubbing the glass and putting their fingers in their mouths, they more likely would get a bigger dose than an adult just holding a glass and drinking something.
If you're a parent, take the glass back to the store or just toss it out. What do you do with it?
I would say that it's time for parents to protect their children and take the glasses back until there's some standardization and that the organizations get together and say enough is enough and we need to protect our children.
All right. Thanks, Jeff. Jeff's website, part of our Twitter feed at coasttocoastam.com, foodsafetycoach.com. St. Louis took Camden, New Jersey's spot as the nation's most dangerous city in 2009. According to a national study, the study by the CQ Press found that St. Louis had 2,070.1 violent crimes per 100,000 residents compared with a national average of 429.4. That helped St. Louis beat out Camden, which topped last year's list as one of the most dangerous cities for 2003-04 and onward. Thousands of Cambodians celebrating a water festival by the river in the Cambodian capital stampeded Monday night, leaving more than 180 people dead, others scattered with hundreds of injuries. ambulances racing back and forth. It was just unbelievable. There in Los Angeles, police are investigating the death of a 2-year-old boy who fell 50 feet from a Staples Center luxury suite after a Lakers game on Sunday night. How sad. Scientists in Israel are drilling into the murky depths of the Dead Sea in hopes of unearthing scientific treasures hidden 500,000 years ago. They think that there could be anything there. The Dead Sea, by the way, the lowest place on Earth at 1,385 feet below sea level. And they think there'll be all kinds of answers to scientific questions ranging from geology to archaeology that could also lead to some insight into these climate change efforts. You know, 47 years ago, November 22nd, 1963, I was 13 years old. This nation lost its president, John F. Kennedy, assassinated. We as a nation lost something as well, something that has been quite never replaced. We lost a part of who we are as a country, who we are as a nation. I remember that day well. I was in English class, and my teacher, Miss Leonard, she walked in crying later that night. I remember my parents watching CBS Evening News with Walter Cronkite as the network replayed this horrific moment, and also all the reporters that were scattered around Dealey Plaza. Listen in.
It appears as though something has happened in the motorcade route. Something, I repeat, has happened in the motorcade route. There's numerous people running up the hill alongside Elm Street, there by the Simmons Freeway. Several police officers are rushing up the hill at this time. Stand by just a moment, please. Something has happened in the motorcade route. Stand by, please. Put me on, Bell. Put me on. The motorcade is coming by here. I can see many, many motorcycles coming by now. Police motorcycles. Just heard a call on the radio for all units along Industrial to pick up the motorcade. Something has happened here. We understand there has been a shooting. The presidential car coming up now. We know it's the presidential car. You see Mrs. Kennedy's pink suit. There's a Secret Service man, spread eagle, over the top of the car. We understand Governor and Mrs. Connolly are in the car with President and Mrs. Kennedy. We can't see who has been hit, if anybody has been hit, but apparently something is wrong here. Something is terribly wrong. I'm in behind the motorcade, trying to follow them. It looks as though they're going to Parkland Hospital. We're on the road to Parkland at this time.
From Dallas, Texas, the flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time, 2 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, some 38 minutes ago. Vice President Lyndon Johnson has left the hospital in Dallas, but we do not know to where he has proceeded. Presumably, he will be taking the oath of office shortly and become the 36th President of the United States.
Well, I'm sure if you were born by that time, you remember exactly where you were. I was in school. Where were you? In a moment, we begin our special report on what has happened to us as a nation. The JFK assassination. It's been 47 years. That's next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Tonight, with our JFK assassination special, we will have four separate guests for you throughout the evening, beginning this hour with Don Adams. He became a special agent of the FBI in 1962. In June of 1964, he was assigned to the Dallas FBI office and participated in the investigation of President John Kennedy's murder. Don is the author of several articles and some special DVDs, the subject of countless media interviews, a very respected authority on the JFK assassination. He has traveled the United States speaking about his ongoing investigation into an individual we'll talk about in a moment and into the murder of President Kennedy. Here's Don Adams on Coast to Coast. Hello, sir. Hi, Don. How are you?
Fine, George. How are you?
Good. And thank you. Tell me about your work with the FBI, how they assigned you to that Dallas office, and how this investigation for you started.
Okay, I'm going to have to jump back to Thomasville, Georgia, before the Dallas move, when I moved over there in May of 64.
Okay.
On November the 13th of 63, I received a telephone call from the agent in charge of the FBI office in Atlanta. I was a first office agent. I had just come out of training school. And so I was going to work in the Atlanta office, and then he wanted me to go to the resident agency, so they transferred me down to Thomasville, Georgia. While I was down there and I received this telephone call, the boss said to me that there was a planned discussion that took place in Indianapolis, Indiana, the last week of October 63. And in that discussion, there was a man by the name of Joseph Adams Miltier, a man by the name of William Somerset, and two other men who they did not name. And they said that Miltier had made threats against the president. They said they were going to go ahead and kill the president as he left Homestead Air Force Base in Florida, driving up to the Kennedy compound in Palm Beach, and that they were going to secrete a sniper up in a palm tree who was willing to give his life, and that they were going to kill the president when he traveled that route on Collins Avenue. If that failed, the second backup plan was they had already rented an apartment behind Lafayette Park in Washington, D.C., and had already purchased a heavy-duty tripod with a heavy-duty weapon, and they were going to shoot the president on the portico or as he was walking on the front grounds, which he did frequently. So those were the two things that were discussed on November the 13th. The boss said he wanted me to get in and do as much work on Joseph Miltier as I could, all the background, and everything was going to be provided to the Secret Service, who made the initial request of the FBI to assist them. So I contacted the chief of police in Quitman, Georgia, where Miltier lived. I told Bill Elliott that I needed to work together with him. We needed to get as much data as we could, and we did. We went to every single possible place that you could think of. We went to the schools. We went to businesses. We went to the police departments, sheriff's offices. We found a set of fingerprints for Miltier at the Valdosta sheriff's office in the basement. We learned that he was living with a prostitute by the name of C.C. Cofield in Valdosta, Georgia, and that he spent more time with her than he did at his residence in Quitman, Georgia.
Don, what would his motivation be in this group?
They were radical, wild right-wingers, and they hated the Kennedys with a passion. And he mimeographed pages and pages and passed his hate literature out like you never saw, George. I mean, the man was obsessed. He literally, in his house, when the chief and I looked in the window of his house, he literally had walkways through mimeographed paper that he had printed out, and it was stacked as high as he could reach it. And the entire first floor of his house was nothing but corridors of a walkway through the all the mimeographed paper it had.
Is he still alive today, Don?
No, he's dead. He died dead. In 1970. He had a coal stove blow up at his house in Quitman, Georgia. They took him to the hospital. They treated him. There's two versions. One says that he was very badly burned. The second one was that he wasn't badly burned and that he was returned back to his house. And then a week later, he died suddenly.
During the course of your investigation, were you ever able to tie him into any of these groups that we've heard about over all these years, Don, the mob or a Cuban faction or anything, or even government?
Well, I couldn't tie him into any of those things, but he did tie into the Ku Klux Klan and all of those supreme organizations, the white supremacists of the South and this Constitution Party, mm-hmm. which they were just forming, and things of that type. But he was in contact with some very prominent people in his travels throughout the United States. And so who his connections were or what they were, I don't know. I know that he was a very wealthy man. His father had left him $200,000 in those days, and he traveled extensively.
That's a lot of money in those days.
It was. It was a lot of money. And as a result of it, he became very, very dedicated to this task of killing the President Kennedy. He's talked about killing Martin Luther King, and he talked about killing Bobby Kennedy. And in the course of discussion about killing Bobby Kennedy, there was connections with Carlos Marcelo and Santo Traficante, who were two mob guys, and they had a tremendous bitter hatred for Bobby Kennedy. And Carlos Marcelo told Santo Traficante that we've got to kill this guy. We've got to kill Bobby Kennedy and take him out of this because he's destroying us as far as the mob operations is concerned in that. And so as a result of it, Traficante said back to him, Marcelo said back to him, wait a minute. If we kill Bobby, we're still going to have to deal with the president and it'll be the wrath of God on us. Yeah. So let's take out Jack Kennedy first, who can't help him then, and that'll defeat Bobby Kennedy.
I will always remember when Oswald Don was arrested on television, you could hear him say, I'm a patsy.
I'm a patsy. That's exactly right. And he was.
Do you think he knew Miltier at all, or he just happened to be down in Dallas at the time?
He was in Dallas at the time. He didn't know Miltier, but he knew all the other people that were involved in that. I mean, he knew Marcelo, and he knew Traficante, and he had contacts, David Ferry and a bunch of people, former agent in charge of the Chicago office who was in New Orleans. So he had a lot of contacts. And the ironic part about it is that Jack Ruby and Lee Harvey Oswald were good friends in New Orleans.
But it's possible then, Don, that Lee Harvey Oswald, Jack Ruby, everybody that Jim Garrison was pointing out, they might have known this guy, Miltier.
Sure. Yeah. Sure. They could have. There's no question about it. The only thing is that when they assigned him to me, it came as a result of that meeting in Indianapolis. And when we did our work on this, we found nothing concerning him tied up with any of these groups.
Okay, so you're in the investigation at 64. Miltier dies in 74. The FBI had 10 years to get this guy. What happened? Why didn't they let you go after him?
Because they didn't want to. I'm going to tell you, George, I've never seen an investigation as bad as this investigation was, as it was done.
Miltier or the entire Kennedy?
No, the entire Kennedy assassination. And I'm going to give you my views on this because I've been very vocal about this.
I know.
LBJ and JFK lived across, I mean, LBJ and J. Edgar Hoover lived across the street from each other in Washington. And they frequented each other every weekend for a lunch or breakfast. And they would discuss everything. When Oswald was named as the assassin, LBJ told J. Edgar Hoover that Lee Harvey Oswald is the assassin and nobody else. Once that word was passed to J. Edgar Hoover, that mentality was passed from Hoover through all of his associates and went down the entire line. And the entire investigation was geared towards Lee Harvey Oswald. And they did nothing, not a single thing in proper form as far as investigation is concerned, but concentrated totally on Lee Harvey Oswald. All of the shots that were fired and the people, how they came in there and where they were secreted to, nobody did anything on any of that stuff.
As an FBI agent, Don, you must have been going nuts because they were trying to quash your investigation.
Well, I'll tell you, George, this is going to sound strange to you, but I went into the service at 32, much older than most agents that come out of college.
Sure.
And because of that, and my father was a police officer for 31 years, and I rode with my dad for 10 years, all summer long, days and evenings. And then even when I went to school and that, I lived with he and my grandparents, and I spent my time with him. I learned more from my dad than I think a lot of people will ever learn in their entire career of investigations. And as a result of it, when I started taking a look at these things, as far as they were developing, I started realizing that there was something seriously wrong here. And I think that they thought that I was a naive young kid coming out of training school and going into my first office, and I wouldn't know what the hell was going on, and they were going to go ahead and assign this case to me, and that I would mess it up, and nothing would ever go with it.
In your opinion, Don, we're going to take a quick break and come back,
sure.
But in your opinion, was there a major government cover-up?
No question. 100%. All the documents that I obtained through the help of Chief Elliott, all of those documents and everything that was given to us, I took a whole bunch of handouts from Miltier on the street corner down there, plus all the work that we had done.
All right, let's get into those documents, Don, when we come right back. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. We're talking with former Special Agent of the FBI, Don Adams, about the JFK assassination and his investigation. As he was talking with us about getting into some documents, we will get into that with him next on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to our JFK special. Don Adams, our special guest this hour. Don, you were talking about some documents that you were going through during this time period. They'll let you refresh us. What'd you discover?
Okay, I'm going to jump up to 2003. We went to the archives.
Okay.
And when we went to the archives, I looked for all my work that I had done in Valdosta and in Quitman. And when we got up there and we searched 4 cartloads of boxes of records concerning Miltier and all of his associates and that, and every single piece of investigation that I had done was gone. And the only document that was in that entire file, all those files, was my interview of Miltier. And all the rest of it was totally gone. Then I found 2 reports that were prepared by my partner, Royal McGraw, in Thomasville, Georgia, and a supervisor by the name of Charles Harding up in Atlanta. And they had taken my material and the people that I had contacted, some of them, and they put them into their reports and made 2 reports and attributed them to themselves, to Royal McGraw and to Charles Harding, and neither one of them ever did a piece of work on Miltier at this time. But then also looking through the reports in Washington, in the report that I was just talking about, I found where my partner interviewed and did a full background investigation under racial matters with Bill Elliott, the chief of police that I worked with in 1962, and never told me a thing about it.
Don, how did you feel? I mean, here you were, an officer of the law. And during those days, there was incredible respect for law enforcement. I mean, Even television had the FBI with Efren Zimbalist Jr. and that TV program. I used to remember watching it as a kid.
Sure.
How did you feel when you were trying to uncover and unravel this thing and you were stymied, documents were gone? You were basically told, you know, hey, don't worry about this kid. You heard things about Hoover, I'm sure, LBJ. How did you feel?
I was devastated. And I want to jump back, if I might, George, to go back to after I had done my full workup on Miltier, and I prepared and gave all the information to the SAC, who in turn had given it to the agent in charge of the Secret Service. As far as I was concerned, I was finished with the investigation, and I felt it was done properly. On the afternoon of the 22nd of November, I and my partner McGraw, I was driving, and he was in the car, and a vehicle pulled up alongside of us and said, "Did you hear what happened in Dallas?" And we said, "No." And they said the president had been shot. So here, just 4 days later, after I finished my investigation, you can imagine how I felt inside. Did I mess up? Did I do something wrong? Well,
yeah.
What the hell's going on here? Exactly. So anyway, we then got a call to call the SAC in Atlanta. I did that, and he said, "Find Miltier and interview him and hold him for the Secret Service right away." He said, "Here's 5 questions that I want you to ask him, and don't ask him anything more." And he told me the 5 questions. I said, "Well, wait a minute, boss." I said, "We could gain so much intelligence from this guy, from the people that he contacted and the travels mm-hmm. that he did in this country. I think we're missing it." He said, "Look, I'm going to tell you something. I told you what I want you to do. You do the 5 questions and nothing else."
And what were the 5, Don? Just general questions?
Well, the one was, did he have any knowledge on the Kennedy assassination? What did he know about Martin Luther King? What did he know about the 4 kids their heads were blown off in Birmingham at the Baptist Church in Birmingham, Alabama, about an agent that he – a former retired agent that he – not retired agent, but a person who had left the FBI and was working in Dallas and about his contact with him. And then there was a question on there on that report that I never asked and I knew nothing about some guy in Missouri and that.
But then he would have said, no. And they should have just turned you loose.
But they wouldn't do that. I mean, he was very specific under the orders of what was told to me in that. That's why, see, the thing is that you have to understand, George, because of the years of experience with Dad and everything else, my wheels were ticking and rolling around and thinking, what the hell is going on here?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, I'm told that I can only answer 5 questions. My partner doesn't tell me. Of course, I didn't learn this till much later. But when I take a look at the total investigation in this thing was totally controlled by government. It was totally done the way they wanted to do it, and they wanted the results, and that's what they got.
In your opinion, Don, why? Why was it cover up? Why was government putting its thumb on you and other people?
I think that J. Edgar Hoover goofed up. He played the ponies. There was a guy by the name of Clint Murchison who lived in Dallas, Texas, who was a very wealthy oil man. Mm-hmm. And he funded and took care of everything for J. Edgar Hoover and for his associate, Clyde Tolson, who was the second in charge of the FBI. And they went out to California every year. Everything was carte blanche, and they lived very well and very comfortable and played the horses.
He loved Santa Anita, didn't he?
And he loved Santa Anita. Yeah. And that's where he went. And once the pressure was put on by Bobby Kennedy to start hitting the mob at that particular point, Hoover was vehement about it. He was very, I could tell you stories about this thing you couldn't believe on how badly he waited.
Let me throw out some names and you tell me whether you believe they were involved in the assassination or not.
Okay.
And then we'll take a few phone calls here. People are lining up to talk with you.
Okay.
Let me start from the top. LBJ, Lyndon Johnson.
Very heavily involved, if not called to all the shots. There's a book out on how LBJ killed JFK, written by Barr McClellan, who is the brother of the fellow who was the press secretary for George W. Bush.
Right.
It's a very good book to read.
Exactly. All right, Hoover, obviously. Yes.
Edgar Hoover was probably, when I went into service, I idolized him. When I started this investigation, I lost total respect for him, and I realized that he was not the man that everyone believed him to be, and that all he cared about was J. Edgar Hoover, and he'd sell his soul for the job.
The mob.
Mob, very heavily involved. I think I mentioned this, they were going to kill Bobby Kennedy first, and then they changed it and said kill John Kennedy, and then you won't have any problems with Bobby. Mob was heavily involved in this thing. Carlos Marcello, Trafficante, all the people up in Chicago. Jack Ruby was a guy by the name of Rubenstein, tied up with the mob in Chicago. A lot of involvement with the mob because Jack's father was heavily involved in bootlegging.
It sure
and
was.
When you tie all that stuff together, those associations and those relationships don't end that easy, and the debts don't end that easy either. The debts right. that they owe out sometimes are never paid.
Lee Harvey Oswald, did he even know what was going on?
Total patsy. I want to tell you this. This is important because I'm doing 3 things that I'm trying to get done. And the first one is Lee Harvey Oswald to say he's not a shooter. If you'll permit me, he was in the employee's lunchroom on the second floor of the Texas Book Depository. And when the shots were fired, moments after that, the superintendent of the building, Truly, or whatever his name was, and the police officer ran into the break room, ran up one set of flight of stairs and went into the employee lunchroom. And there was Oswald standing there drinking a Coke, which was half drunk. And he wasn't perspiring. He wasn't breathing hard. And he was very calm. And mm-hmm. the police officer walked up to him and said, "Who are you?" And he said, "I'm Lee Harvey Oswald." He said, "What are you doing here?" He said, "I work here." Police officer looked at Truly. Truly said, confirmed that he was him, and said, "Okay, let's go and we'll find the shooters wherever they are in the building." And they took off and left him standing there. But the important part about it is that there were like four other employees who saw Oswald standing on the first floor just moments before the motorcade was scheduled to come around off Main Street to Houston Street to Elm Street.
I got a call from a caller about a year ago, Don, a woman who lived in Dallas who was by the school book depository, who said she saw Oswald and then saw another man with a gun, and it wasn't Oswald, and she swears by that.
Mm-hmm. I believe that very much so. What you said, you picked up on right away when you said about the Patsy. Nobody pays attention to that. But this man said he was a Patsy, and as a result of it and that, what he said was 100% true. And when you trace all the way and go back to New Orleans and then come all the way through with Ruby and that and all the contacts and the people that they met and what they did, there's no question in my mind that he did not do the shooting. The other thing that you have to think about is that the president was allegedly shot from the loft and Oswald shot him from the back. If you look at the president's face laying on the gurney, which there are a lot of medical pictures of him,
yes,
his face is totally intact.
Yeah.
If he had been hit to the back of the head, his face would have been gone. And then when you take a look at the throat shot, which I remember, I got to tell you these two stories. When I got to Dallas, the boss said to me, there's two things I want you to do. I want you to take a look at the Zapruder film first, and then I want you to go to the book depository and take a look at those two places. And because you're going to get a lot of work on this thing and you're going to get calls on it, so familiarize yourself with those two things. Yeah. 2 days later, I went in and I looked at the Zapruder film. And when I'm watching the Zapruder film, I have two senior agents who are with me, one on one side, one on the other side. And I'm watching the film, and all of a sudden I see his hands flare, his elbows flare up into the air. I see his hands go to the throat, and I said, hell, he didn't get shot from the back. He got shot from the front.
And they came up with this cockamamie excuse of how the back goes back and when you get shot from the back.
Yeah,
and
that was ridiculous. I mean, they lied about everything.
Was it a triangular shoot? The grassy knoll, school book depository,
yeah,
and somewhere else?
Yes, it was definitely from all those locations. And there were 11 shots that I can account for that were fired in Dallas, Texas. And there were more shots than that, but 11 of them I can account for. And the sad part about it is that Oswald, they found a weapon with his palm print on it. That weapon was hidden up under some boxes up on the second floor. But before that weapon came out, they found a Mauser. And then the Mauser disappeared, and then the man like a Carcona came out after that.
E. Howard Hunt, who was implicated in the Watergate scandal during Nixon's era, on his deathbed told his son, and he knew about the Kennedy assassination.
Right.
He claimed that he was basically part of it. Did his name ever come up in any of your investigations?
No. I mean, I heard all the statements that he made and allegedly that he was involved in the assassination. Once you're dying, you can say whatever you want. And as you know, maybe he was, maybe he wasn't. But in all the work that I did, I never heard his name mentioned until probably 2 months ago.
Well, what tells me, Don, is this thing involved so many people, and you may be absolutely right. Miltier was probably part of that group as well, and it's been so covered up. And I think you'll agree with me, Don, that we've lost something since that assassination as people. Let's take some calls. Let's go to Jimmy, first-time caller in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Jimmy, you're on with Don Adams. Go ahead.
George, Don, how are you this evening?
Fine. Good. Hi, Jimmy. How are you?
I'm doing very well. I'm intrigued. I was born in 1969, and I had an uncle that I spoke with years ago. I was probably a freshman or a sophomore in high school, and he told me something that blew my mind. He said that the day of the assassination, in the hours following it, he had seen a review of the assassination on television. There was an angle that he never saw again. And he's not the only I went to Mount Lebanon High School in the South Hills of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and I talked to a teacher in that same year, a history teacher, told me the same exact thing, and I've heard it several times since from different people. I then went to Slippery Rock University, and I talked to somebody there, a professor there, who said that he had heard that many times. And I wonder, have you ever heard of an angle of the assassination that was played and then not seen again?
I have not. That's all new information to me. But I do want to tell you this, Jim, that there was so much twisting of facts and improper investigations and all the things that they did to cover up and so on, that I wouldn't put anything past anybody to do anything in that investigation, because there was never a more botched up investigation conducted supposedly by 385 FBI agents. But you see, the thing is, these people can't talk. They've got a wife and they've got kids at home. And if they say something, just like I was cautioned, I went to the book depository. And with two other older agents. And when I made the statement, when I looked out the window and I said, hell, there's no way in the world he could have fired three rounds in 7.5 seconds. I saw 7,000.
They probably told you, keep quiet, Don. Don't say that in public.
He did. He said the warrant commission's in here. They're doing their findings. And whatever you do, don't put yourself in a bad position. And from that point on, I mean, there was no discussion. I mean, you won't believe this. I worked in Dallas until I got transferred to Lubbock, Texas, and there was never a time for lunch, breakfast, or anything that the Kennedy assassination was ever discussed. I went to Lubbock, worked there 3.5 years, came back to Dallas for another year, and in that second year that I was back there, never one bit of discussion concerning the assassination. And I didn't know anything about this. My friend sent me a book in 1993 from Houston, Texas. And in that book, which is it's an eye-opener to me, because it shows Miltier standing there looking at the limousine just moments before the president was killed. And that morning at 10 o'clock, Miltier called Somerset, the informant in Miami, and told him, I'm in Jackrabbit country. Your friend is coming here, and you're never going to see him again.
Oh, my.
So there was just so much of this stuff that went on. There was a tape recorded. Let me tell you this one here, George, and it's important for you to know.
Sure. All right. We've got about a minute or so with you.
Okay.
Go ahead.
In November the 9th of 63, the Miami Intelligence Unit placed a police unit for recording purposes in Somerset's apartment. In that tape-recorded conversation, Miltier said, we're going to go ahead and kill the president from an office building with a high-powered rifle. And Somerset says to him, who was his boyhood friend and trusted him, and he didn't know that he was a snitch for the local authorities and for the FBI. And as a result of that, Somerset said, are you sure they're going to do this? He said, it's already in the workings. That's November the 9th. That's 4 days or 5 days before I started my investigation. That president should have never gone to Dallas, Texas, when there's that kind of discussion. And there were four other, I mean, there was a Chicago threat, there was a Tampa threat, there were two in Miami. I mean, this was the most horrendously bad investigation that I have ever seen in my life.
On purpose, Don.
On purpose.
On purpose. Yep.
On purpose.
They knew what they were doing. They knew,
sure they did.
They knew how to cover up. Well, I want to thank you for sticking your neck out. Going public with this.
I just want to tell the truth. I'm like you. What you said, history changed in 1962 when they killed the president. If you kill the president, you can kill anything. From that point on, anything is open game. And
well, your website, of course, I want people to go to it. It's adamsjfk.com, adamsjfk.com. It's linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Don, thank you for being on the program and again, for doing what you did. Our coverage of the November 22nd, 1963 assassination of JFK continues in a moment.